21-28-20, Corey Jarvella versus Richard Hoke. Arguments of 20 minutes to be shared by appellant and amicus, 20 minutes for the appellee. Mr. Van Stempfort for the appellant.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Steve Van Stempfort for the appellant, Deputy Hoke. And I'll be speaking, I think, for just 8 minutes at my outset, and then Mr. Peters will be handling five another minutes, and I'll reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, if that's okay.
Good to us.
Thank you. So with respect to the failure to warn piece, you know, our submission...
Is the shouting to the heavens come out or you might get bit?
Exactly. Okay. Right. So obviously our position, there's no constitutional violation here. I think one of the ways to understand the district court's error is that it really imposed a one-size-fits-all approach to the use of dog canines, or canines by police. And there's simply, you know, there's multiple different ways that dogs can be used. One way to understand it is that, you know, there's a difference between a bounded area search and then using a dog on a leash to track a suspect who's kind of fled into the open. Bounded area search would be an example of that would be the Burgess case, where the suspect went into the crawl space and the officers knew where he was. And so they were able to have a conversation with him, warn him, say, hey, if you don't come out, we're going to send a dog in. And so they were able to have that sort of, you know repartee. Same in Robinette, right? Same in Robinette, where they knew the individual was in the car dealership, and so they saw him, and they said, okay, look, we're going to send a dog in if you don't come out. This situation obviously is much different. This is where, you know, Jarvella ran off into the woods. The officer didn't arrive with a canine until 15 minutes later, had no idea where he was, and kept him on the leash. And that's another distinct feature here, where in the Melgar case from the Fourth Circuit, I think is very helpful on this, where he explained, look, if there's a difference between releasing a dog off a leash, especially into a bounded area where you know a suspect is, it might make some sense to have some discussion, you know, saying, hey, look, we know you're here, we know you can hear us, we're gonna send this dog in. Much different scenario than if you keep the dog on a leash and are trying to find him, you know, when you don't know where he is. So,
you know, sometimes it's not a terrible idea to have some bright line rules. I mean, one I could see here is why the leash helps, of course, on your side, but this looked like a situation where they were necessarily going to let the dog bite the guy. And that looked like that was the plan of action here. This is why you have the dog. It helps you find the person, obviously senses that the human doesn't have. That's all good. But this looked like it didn't matter what happened. They were going to use the dog to immobilize the person. That was going to be their first line of dealing with this situation. And it's not obvious from looking at the film that was necessarily a good idea. I mean, he's lying down. It's drunk driving. There's no indication he's got a gun or that's the problem. I can still understand wanting to use a dog to find the person and that also being helpful if things went bad. But when you're watching it, it's not obvious why they need to have the dog bite into his arm 26 stitches later. Am I right in thinking that was their plan of action?
Well, no, I would say it's not, right? The use of the dog is to go and find the individual, right?
So why in this case did they need to use the dog to bite him?
Well, they wouldn't have if they had been able to see him, right? I mean, the problem here is that there was no opportunity to see him. So they had the dog, right? They used the dog. And the Robinette case, right, from this court says, look, dogs are actually a favored use of force, right? You'd rather have a dog do this than to use some other element of force, right, which may be more lethal. So they use the dog, and of course the dog is trained to seize, but when you're tracking a dog, if you don't necessarily just stumble upon somebody in the weeds, right? I mean, the problem here is that they were looking for him, and the dog went into the weeds, and the officer had no idea.
They had a flashlight. I thought it was pretty obvious there he is. And it wasn't obvious to me why the dog had to bite him. That's my question.
Right, right. So
the dog was helpful, and you know he finds clothes. He's a good dog, but why the bite at that point?
Well, because the officer, and I think you know it's fairly clear from the video that there wasn't an opportunity for the officer to warn Mr. Jarvella after the dog found him. I mean, you can see the dog go into the weeds, and then suddenly there's a scuffle, and Mr. Jarvella, you know, is up, and they're already entangling with the dog.
That's not how it appears to me. I thought there was time to say either don't bite him or whatever the German command is, stop biting him.
I think the district court, the district court didn't identify when the warning should be given, right? And so
I'm not focused on the district court opinion. I'm focused on just what the law should be And that's the hardest part for me, is
right.
That one point right there.
Right. Well,
when you say the plan was for the dog to find him, I mean, you know, in what manner would the dog indicate he has found him? It seemed to me that, like, the plan, as Chief Judge Sutton said, is the dog finds him by seizing him, i.e. biting him, as opposed to sort of like a pointer dog, you know, saying, like, here, there's a partridge in the bush over here, you know. And I mean, a dog could do that. There's no reason in the world why a dog, unless these guys can't do that.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
but
so it has.
So which one was it? I mean, is the find, is that a kind of a euphemism for, you know, find and bite?
Well, so this dog in particular was trained, I think, to, you know, when they find the dog, then, or when they find the suspect, then yes, you know, it's a seizure.
Okay, so find him. So
exactly.
So the plan is to bite him.
But it depends how they find the suspect, right? So you can be walking up and you can find the suspect and you can see the suspect far away. Now, he's on a short leash, right? A 5 to 10 foot leash.
Okay.
And so if you have a situation where you find the suspect in the woods and he's, you know, a little bit distance away, there's a clearing way, across a clearing.
The dog goes crazy barking or something.
Well, then the officer can see him, right? Exactly.
Right.
And you're on the lead, and that's what the Melgar case talks about, right? If you got a fairly short lead here, the officer is going to be able to, you know, potentially control the dog before there's a seizure by the dog. And I guess the second point I would make is, you know, regardless of what we think about the, you know, what the baseline rule should be, I think it's pretty clear that this court hasn't clearly established one in this particular context, right?
Yeah.
The district court hasn't identified one. And the cases that the district court pointed to, you know, Rainey, very different on the facts. Campbell, very different on the facts, right? None of the cases that this court has decided has said, look, there's a...
This is why I'm asking the question of what the dog can do. Is it a dog that only can do one or the other? I mean, imagine if you don't have a dog, and the theory of the police when you're going out in the woods like this is you always, as soon as you see the person, seize first, ask questions later. So the seizure, let's say theoretically, is a taser. So you always bring a taser, and when you're in this kind of a situation, as soon as you see, shoot first, that's the seizure. That's what the analogy is to what they're doing with the dog, unless you're telling me, no, that's not how it works. In this particular case, he happened to seize because there wasn't time to think about it, or it was
right.
A stressful situation. I just can't figure out what this is.
It's that latter situation. Because clearly, for example, cases like Robinette, they say, look, you can use dogs like this. It's actually a benefit to everybody to have the use of canines in these particular situations, right? Because it's actually potentially less lethal force. You're not going to, you know, potentially be danger to surroundings.
Wouldn't you? I would potentially think a taser is better than a dog bite. The dog bite was quite vicious. I mean, 26 stitches. Taser caused no harm. Why is that? That Robinette is 1988. I don't know when tasers came around, but they seem to cause less harm than a dog bite.
I'm not an expert on the
they weren't around,
force, right? I mean, when they came around, but I mean,
I don't remember tasers in college. That wasn't
fair enough, Your Honor. So I mean, but I mean, from our perspective, right? From the Deputy Houck's perspective, right? I mean, Robinette is on the books, right? And the other thing is, you know, courts across the country have approved the use of dogs
in
these situations.
Clearly established aside, query whether the Fourth Amendment can take into account new technology and think that older technology is now maybe a little outdated. I mean, the dog is still useful for searching, but query whether it's as useful for seizing.
Yeah, my time is up. I can answer your question if you'd like. Or
no, please do.
So certainly, you know, the law can change, right? I mean, you know, to accommodate new technologies, right? You see that in the search and seizure context, right, where there, you know, the cell phones have kind of changed the analysis of the Fourth Amendment. But I think, with respect to the canines, I don't think there's been any showing that, you know, canines are somehow totally outmoded. Certainly not this particular type of canine. Again, I think the Melgar case is appropriate on that.
Okay, we'll hear from your colleagues.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
John Peters on behalf of the National Association of Professional Canine Handlers and Mickey's in this case. First of all, I want to thank the court for inviting us to share with the court and perhaps answer any questions the court may have about.
What's your take on this idea of using, you know, the dog really, there's no difference between alert and seize. Well, what's your take on that?
Judge, I'm glad that you asked that question because when you raised it, I wanted to go right to that. In this case, if Deputy Houck's intent was to physically seize the suspect with the dog, then his best course of action was to issue the warning cut the dog loose from the leash and stand off, let the dog locate Mr. Jarvella and bite him and seize him. And according to the lower court's rule, that would have been okay because he would have given a warning. So in my...
Don't worry about the lower court's rule for what
okay.
it's worth.
All right.
That's just not how we're thinking about
so
it.
So generally, Your Honor, in those circumstances, whoever the officer is, they would have that option. Under the existing law, they could have given a warning, released the dog from the leash. The dog can still locate when he's not on the leash, maybe even faster, and physically seize the suspect if that was the intent of the officer. That's why it appears in this case to me, based on the training and based on what Deputy Houck did, that it was not his intent to use the dog to physically
seize. What do you think the plan was?
I think his plan was to locate Mr. Jarvella. He doesn't know. It's a very large, unbounded area.
Job one, where is this guy?
And then he's got a cover officer with him, so once he can locate him, if they can actually physically see him, then they can take possession of Mr. Jarvella. The two officers can take possession of him.
But your co-counsel, so to speak, said that finding basically does equate to seizing, i.e. biting.
It does, except I think where the point of distinction is that Officer Houck or Deputy Houck is keeping that lead. And normally these are, by the way, about usually a 15-foot lead. A tracking lead is set at 15 feet, sometimes 30 feet. He, as I understand it from the record, he had shortened this up to 5 to 8 feet. That indicates to me he's exercising a large element of control to avoid that outcome. Otherwise, for his own safety even, he's better off using a longer lead and letting the dog just seize the suspect.
From my view of the video, it would not have been that difficult either to prevent the initial seizure or to stop it right away. These guys lying down. I mean, other than the fact it's dark, but, you know, it's a drunk driving situation.
Right.
So that's the part I'm trying to just sort out in my head. Why leave him biting this guy's arm for the whole encounter?
So what can happen in these cases, as it happened in Melgar with the underage youth who did nothing more than he was drinking and he passed out in some bushes, and the officer put him on a very short lead, very similar here, and his belief was he could avoid any such outcome. He didn't intend any such outcome, but the dog located the individual first, and he's trained to seize if he locates them, if the officer doesn't exercise enough control to prevent it from happening.
Yeah, now, do you think it matters? So I think there may be a dispute about whether the officers saw him initially, but should the officer have continued to issue the seize command? I think Chief Judge Sutton's point is he's down on the ground, and then rather than calling the dog off to try to just handcuff him, he told the dog to seize.
Yeah, Judge Murphy, what I understand is that Mr. Jarvella was actively fighting with the dog, and the dog is taught that if the suspect is resistant and is literally fighting with
him. I got to say, 26 stitches, and
yeah.
He's supposed to go.
Yeah,
nice Fido. No,
instinct takes over. I mean, the animal's like chewing your bicep
dog
off.
Food here.
So
resisting is like, I mean, who wouldn't do something about this, right?
Well,
what
I can't argue.
Have you seen the video?
Yes, I have, Your Honor.
Okay. So we're talking about the same. We've seen this.
I understand. And I think that, you know, this was triggered. In the end, the encounter with the dog was triggered by Mr. Jarvella. And I think he was surprised by the dog. He reacted. The dog did what it was trained to do in that circumstance. Had he not done that, or at any point, presented himself and said, I'm surrendering, I'm coming out, I don't think we would have had this.
You're the training expert. Why is the training kind of all or nothing at all? Why not, you know, back to Judge Kaplan's thing, some days it's a pointing situation, some days it's a biting situation and seize. Why wasn't this a pointing situation?
Because
bark. Just bark when you see somebody.
The dogs will bark, to Judge Kaplan's question. Yes, they do. As they get closer to locating a suspect, there's changes in behavior in the dog that cue the handler that this guy is close, okay? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, as in this case, the dog finds the individual before the officer physically sees the individual. But in this case, I don't think that's what led to the outcome. I think it's the fact that Mr. Jarvella was surprised by the dog. He engaged the dog. The dog engaged with him. That was not the intended outcome, and that's not normally going to be the outcome. And again, if that was the intent, all Deputy Houck needed to do, even under the existing rule, was to issue a warning into this unknown area, wait a sufficient amount of time and release the dog from the leash and to seize Mr. Jarvell.
I mean, this is a helpful discussion. I mean, picking up on Chief Judge Sutton's point, I mean, maybe, you know, the crux of the case here is, okay, the officer's starting to get some cues and we're getting close and but, you know, there appears to be this interval short where it seems like they found the guy. He has been found. It's pretty clear he's probably right there. And the officer makes no effort to prevent the sort of the bite, you know? I mean, it's likely we found the guy and now we're going beyond finding and we're just going to go to bite him when he's just laying there. And why shouldn't we say that? Maybe it's just too fast to process it, but I mean, there is this moment. It's like, okay, he's found. So why is he getting, you know, mauled here?
I think my review of it in the court, I respect the court.
Yeah, no, we want to hear what you think.
I think that this transpired in very rapid fashion, and that's not an unusual result when it happens in that fashion. I'm sure, as I said, if that was Deputy Houck's intent, he was much better served by issuing the warning, not entering the perimeter at all and releasing his dog to locate and seize Mr. Jarvella. I think he took a much more prudent approach. And under qualified immunity, we've told these officers that unless there's a clearly established rule to the contrary, if you take a reasonable approach, you're going to be protected from civil liability.
A downside with just a bright line, the district court's bright line rule of warning in all cases. The court has been on a kind of the last 20 years suggesting that bright line rules are better than standards just to help police officers in training. So what's wrong with a bright line rule that says, warn, maybe at the very beginning of the outset, said, hey, we're coming in with a dog, come out, or you might get seized by the dog. That's costless in some respects. It doesn't cost.
Judge Murphy, I'm glad that you asked that because I can tell you, I teach these classes all over the country. I have for 15 years. This is in the top two or three questions that I get from handlers. If I'm in a tracking situation with a fleeing suspect in a wooded area or an unbounded area, especially if it's at night or darker, do I have to give the warning? If I do, how do I give the warning? How often? At what distance? Is every 50 feet, every 100 feet?
Why don't they want to give the warning?
Pardon?
Why don't they want to give the warning?
Because it gives the suspect who has fled and actively concealed themselves the opportunity to ambush the officer. And that was Sergeant Yount's point in his affidavit attached to my amicus brief, is they don't do that specifically for that reason.
That's the answer to his question.
Yes. And it's too difficult. They're so fact-driven, these deployments, that it would be almost impossible to fashion a hard, bright-line rule.
But, I mean, I think we're trying to grapple with the sort of principal question of, you know, where is the constitutional line or what is the constitutional principle here? I mean, what about something that, you know, if it's reasonably apparent to the officer that the suspect has been found, and the officer, and it's practicable for the officer to sort of restrain the animal from biting, that the officer has a duty to do that. Could you live with that?
Yes, Judge, I think we already have that rule, actually. I really do think we already have that rule.
How do you think that applies to these facts?
Well, that's the problem. We leave it to the judgment of the handler because he's the one trained in the application.
But if we had that rule, then if that's a legal boundary, then we have to police that. No pun intended, really. So we would say, okay, well, you know, maybe it was reasonably apparent, and did the officer, you know, was it practicable for the officer to restrain the dog from biting the guy in this instance? If that were the question here.
I think that's more of a guideline than a bright line rule. I understand what you're articulating. I think there's three considerations. There's
you're saying we can't have bright line rules in this area.
I don't
think
we can.
Because it's too fact bound.
Right.
You know?
And
there's so many variables.
Yes, exactly.
Innumerable.
Exactly. And believe me, the handlers sometimes wish there were bright line rules. This is a high point of concern to them because their safety is involved. Certainly the safety of the individual that they're pursuing is involved. And the safety of innocent people sometimes can be at stake. The officers are not interested. If they could design the outcome, in this case, Mr. Jarvella would have simply presented himself and surrendered, and that's it. Everybody's safe. Nobody's hurt. The dog's not at risk. The officer's not at risk. Mr. Jarvella's not at risk. But Mr. Jarvella drove this outcome, at least as I see it. He had many opportunities to avoid us even being here to talk about this. And the officer,
I think... that often? You said innocent people. Has it happened that often you go into the woods and the dog finds the wrong person and...
No, it's not often, but it can happen. And when a dog in particular is released, you have less control over the outcome. And that's what the courts have recognized, that distinction between leashed and unleashed dog. So, yeah, the protection of innocent people is a concern, too. And these are all concerns of the handler. The handler doesn't want his dog injured. He doesn't want to get injured.
Out in the woods, and along comes the dog. Boom.
If the dog is released, yes. And that's why the courts have said, one of the reasons why they want the warning given before the dog is released. But that's the distinction, released versus
sure.
leashed and under
that's
some...
So dangerous to the officer. He's not going to get ambushed if, you know...
Once he releases it. Correct. Yeah, once he releases the dog,
yeah.
That's his... best protection because he's got distance and the dog is doing what he's trained to do.
You ought to release this video in connection with advertising campaigns to stop drunk driving. Curb a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, again, I think Mr. Jarvella in the lower court said, you know, Officer Deputy Houck did not give a fair opportunity to avoid this outcome to Mr. Jarvella. I don't see where that is. I think there were multiple opportunities and whatever rule this court decides to fashion, I want you to know that I'm here on behalf of the amicus party, but in a larger sense, I'm here on behalf of the more than 200,000 police canine handlers that deal with these issues every day, and I can tell you it's a very real concern to them. I get this question without a doubt. It's in the top three questions I get from handlers all the time.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Cabot.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sean Cabot on behalf of the appellee.
Good morning.
Obviously a very interesting and, as Your Honor has acknowledged, fact-intensive case, and I think that's the key here. And I think that's one of the things I know, Judge Sutton, I think it was you that said, well, kind of put the district court opinion aside, but I think that is key here is that this is very fact-intensive, especially when you consider...
One thing that's not fact-intensive is clearly established.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you answer that?
I agree with the district court. I think there was clearly established cases in this situation. Those cases that the district court cited going back, I mean, we can start as far back as 1997 with the Monday case, which is the general proposition that an officer can only use that degree of force that's reasonable to complete an arrest. So that's decades old. Then we can move forward a little bit to the Shreve case, which was a Sixth Circuit case back in 2006, and says people who pose no safety threat, not supposed to use force on here. I think that,
no, that's not your client, though. I mean, these are people who are sort of, you know, you can see them in plain sight, and they're laying prone, and they're not a threat as opposed to somebody who's in the woods.
Well, I would disagree in that with this case because, as the district court acknowledged, and I think the video a reasonable juror could see is that he was laying down at the time before he was attacked. And so I think the fact that he was not resisting at that moment, nor had he, they didn't even hear anything.
I mean, you know, you feel for your client once the dog starts to bite, right? But you feel for the officers as you're standing in their shoes in the dark wondering where this person is, and the flashlight only can show spots at a time, and it really does happen pretty instantaneously.
Well,
they see him and the dog bites him.
I guess that's a jury question, right? Because I would believe there was time to withhold that dog from biting it. There's a couple things here. I think the testimony revealed that he was on a 15-foot lead, and so that's quite a bit of distance. And so Addie shortened up on that, for instance, especially
thought,
as...
I thought he did shorten up. Is that... what's the testimony that it was a longer lead than, like, 5 to 7?
I believe... I believe at the beginning it was 15. I don't recall if it shortened up.
You know what witness you're referring to here?
I believe that was Hoke's testimony.
But what matters is what it was at the time of the encounter. Mm-hmm. I thought I heard, you know, kind of 8 to 10 feet or even 5 to 6.
Okay. Even that, I think, especially...
Wait, your job is to tell us what the facts are.
Yeah. It's helpful to have a record site for this sort of thing, but you don't want to derail your arguments.
I mean, I think... Whichever way you look at it, whether it's 10 to 15, whether it's 5 to 10, or whether it's 4 to 5, I think the fact when the officer sees that T-shirt and the officer sees...
That's, oh, he's not wearing it, though.
Correct, but it's a clear indication that you're getting to where
not Mr. necessarily. Jerry. I mean, he could have left that and, you know, headed for the hills.
Well,
this guy, I mean, your client runs off, you know, this guy comes 15 minutes later. I mean, we do have to credit the officer. He doesn't know if your client is armed. He doesn't know where he is. He's going off into the dark. It's quite dangerous for him, for the officer.
And
finding a T-shirt doesn't relieve the danger.
But I think it indicates that you're getting close to where that person is. And I think the other thing...
The person has been there, might have been there 15 minutes ago. I mean, I don't see how that dissipates any threat at all.
Well, I think, you know, this goes into some of the cases that deal with the stealth mode, right? When you watch the video, neither Deputy Hoke nor Officer Trevino are taking any efforts whatsoever to be quiet. They're not taking any efforts whatsoever to kind of find him quietly. I mean, the radios are on, that you can clearly hear the talk back in the radio. I think at one point they're talking about some days off that are coming up. They're certainly not whispering. They're certainly not trying to be quiet. So I think that undermines their argument that, you know, we're afraid here, because if you were truly afraid or concerned, and I'm not saying there isn't a level of concern, but you would certainly minimize the threat of being ambushed by being loud. There was no efforts from the video.
I mean, that would seem to me to cut in the officer's favor. It's sort of like they're being plain about their own approach and giving your client kind of like a more, you know, muted warning that you ought to come out before something bad happens. I mean, if they snuck up on him and the dog all of a sudden pounces on your guy, that's one thing. If your guy can hear them coming from 50 feet away and he keeps hiding in the grass, and now there's a split second where, okay, I can see him, but Argo or whatever the dog's name was is like on him, then whose fault is that?
Well, and kind of going with that, Judge Kethledge, if they're using this non-silent communication and they're whatever, then it lends to the question, why couldn't they say, hey, if you don't come out, we're going to unleash a dog? I mean, it goes directly to that.
Fair answer.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'd have to prove causation between the... I thought the argument may have evolved between the briefing and the argument. I thought it was the failure to warn was the main Fourth Amendment violation, and now it seems to be the bite. But with respect to the failure to warn, is there any evidence whatsoever that if they had shouted, we've got a dog, that your client would have come out? I thought the evidence was your client was passed out, and the first thing he remembers is being bitten by a dog under his point of view.
Right.
So
that is what he testified
okay,
to.
Okay, so where's how in the world is a warning going to have prevented the encounter here?
Because,
what is the evidence of that?
Because I think if you would have shouted, hey, you know, raised your voice, yelled this.
Come on.
But this is true, though.
His testimony was he was passed out. He doesn't remember anything. And he came to when a dog is on his arm. Yeah, I can see you coming to when you're being bitten. But a shout, I just don't see any, like, the between the harm and the, you do have to prove causation, right? Between the Fourth Amendment violation and your theory is the failure to warn, I don't see any damages.
Well, we also.
So your theory has to be somehow the canine bite was.
We also can't step into the shoes of a jury either at a summary judgment 56.
Well, yes, we can. Genuine issue of material fact. We ask, is there a genuine, where is the evidence that this warning would have done anything? Don't you can't rely on speculation. I mean, that's well established.
Well, I think a reasonable inference is that had they raised their voices and made a command to come out, or we're going to let the dog out, it could have roused him.
Did your client testify? Oh yeah, I would have come out. You're right. I ran I drove my car drunk. I ran away after I crashed it into a tree. But if they had told me that they had a dog, I was going to come out and...
I don't believe the question was asked.
Okay. Okay.
Going back, and I'm going to hit and miss some of these questions, I think there was one question that...
You know, one, if you don't mind, just unclearly established, just tell us your best case. Like, just not a bunch of cases, but the one you think, if we read it, we would have to acknowledge
you know, facts are the closest, and I think there's the most helpful.
Probably two of them, and I would say...
that's all.
Campbell case, which has two cases in it.
Campbell?
Okay. Campbell versus City of Springboro. It has the Gemper Line incident.
We'll look at it.
Okay. And then I think Rainey versus Patton. Okay.
Rainey?
Yep.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
And so going back to kind of hit and missing some of these topics that the court hit on, there was a question about the what was the dog trained to do? And if you look at page 33 and 34 of Deputy Hoke's deposition, he testified that the purpose of the dog was to find and bite. I mean, that was page 34. So there's not any indication from Deputy Hoke himself that his intent, what was going to happen was this dog was going to bite whoever found. And that was it. And that was his testimony on page 34 of his deposition, find and bite. I think that eliminates the question of what the dog's function was.
Do you think, just to analogize, if instead of using a dog, once they discovered your client, they tased him immediately, do you think that would have been okay?
Well, I believe that the tasing case law, and you know, going back, Judge Murphy, to your prior questions, I think the tasing case law generally says that if you can give a warning before you tase, you're supposed to do that too. And so if we go along that line with the tasing example, I would agree then even in that situation that established case law says, look, you got to give a tasing if you can before you tase somebody. And so the same principle would apply here with a dog.
So what's tricky is that there was probable cause to arrest him. So there was going to be a physical seizure since he ran off. And so the question is, once you found him, did you have to give him the opportunity to continue to run, or could you immediately incapacitate him once you found him? And why wasn't there a probable cause that he would run again if you gave the warning, just simply based on the fact that he had run at the outset?
Well, I think that what's interesting with the whole probable cause analysis and this kind of exigency question is that when he initially, you know, hits the tree and he exits the vehicle, I believe it's Trevino that says it was 12 or 15 minutes before they even went after him, which creates a question, right? Because Trevino, according to this deposition, there had been three or four prior encounters with him. He knew who he was. None of those encounters, at least for him, was there any indication that there was violence or guns or weapons or anything like that. But I think what goes along to that question about the exigency is he doesn't do anything. He waits literally at his car. He looks in the vehicle to see if there is anything in there. And then, in fact, I believe at one point he even moves his police vehicle. And it's 10, 15 minutes. So I don't think they're really worried about that, to be quite candid, about the arrest. Because if he was, you know, he certainly could have called for backup. He could have gone in the woods. They had flashlights. We have that in the video, that they were flashlights. There was a house in the background that had a light on. The grass where they were at, especially for a lot of where they were at, was mowed. I don't think, you know, dealing with this probable cause, I don't think that was really a concern for them, to be quite candid. Because if it was, they would have done something immediately. And the other thing is that why, you know, how long do we give Argo to keep biting Mr. Jarvell? I mean, this goes on for a long time.
Well, I mean, that it does get complicated. I get your point about the initial seizure, but it does get complicated because it's not just stop or, you know, get off of me, I'll do what you want. I mean, he's attacking the dog, and I, you know, maybe we would all do the same thing.
but that's a little complicated.
Well,
Do you agree, or I
disagree with the paraphrasing of it. He's attacking the dog, and I think when you listen to the video and you read the testimony, they're giving him commands. He's laying on his back. This dog's now latched onto his right bicep. You have Officer Hoke yelling to the dog to bite and continue to bite, and for him to roll over. Well, he's got two options: roll to the right, roll to the left. And obviously, you know, his testimony was he's trying to get the dog's
on top of the dog.
He rolls to his right because that's where the dog is biting his arm. Hoke gives the command, roll on your stomach, and so he rolls to his right side to get on his stomach. Naturally, because of that command and him following that command, Argo ends up underneath him.
It's hard to believe your client was, you know, his coherence was not high, so, you know, the fact that he was misled, I'm not sure, I don't know about that, but the bottom line is he's on top of the dog.
At the command of Deputy Hoke.
Yeah, well,
I don't know. And he, you know,
but what's your point? Your point is that they should have said release as soon as he's on top of the dog?
Well, once he's compliant, which our argument is there's nothing in the video that shows he wasn't, they should have backed the dog off, pulled him back, told him to stop, but instead, Hope keeps saying to bite. Bite, bite, bite. You know, why?
What is, so assume that your client's subjective intent doesn't matter and it's more the objective circumstances for the police officer. Is there any law on what officers can do if they think their dog is being attacked by a suspect? I mean, what amount of force would if I know you disagree, but assume that objectively we thought that there was evidence that the dog was being attacked. Is that enough to use a taser, first, and number two, to the hits that were made of your client? Would probable cause that your client is attacking a dog give the officers justification to physically kind of hit your client?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any case specifically addressing that. I'm assuming the argument would be that because the dog is an extension of an officer, that probably the officer would argue that, well, if this was happening to me, this is what I could do. But of course, this is a situation where the facts are in dispute, whether or not he was fighting the dog and for how long.
That's kind of where my question was going, actually, because I didn't see a lot of law either. So why would we say that it's clearly established that they couldn't use the subsequent force that they did, given that I really don't see what the law is when they think that their dog is being attacked?
Well, my argument to that would be, had you followed the law of giving a warning in a situation where you could have, which the law was clearly established when you can give that warning, then you wouldn't, my argument is you wouldn't have gotten to that point. I know there's been a dispute about whether he would have responded or not, but that's how I would respond to that. The other part, kind of the ending part to your question, Judge Murphy, was the blows to the head, which I think, you know, has not been addressed, but that is part of this appeal. My client, and you can hear it, and you could see it, there was approximately 7 blows. He testified to the back of the head. Now, I asked both Trevino and Hoke, as officers on the scene, because remember, that's part of the analysis, right? What would a reasonable officer on the scene have done? And I asked both of them, was it reasonable? Was there any reason? Was there any justification to punch him 7 times in the head? They both said no. Now, Deputy Hope will say it was in the shoulder area. The testimony from Mr. Jarvella was that it was the back of the head. And so I think that part, even if, depending on whatever happens with the other part, I think that part is clearly a jury question. Clearly, summary judgment was appropriately denied, because you have officers on the scene saying, look, that was not reasonable, although you have Deputy Hook saying, well, I didn't do that. And so...
So the jury question on that point, as you just described it, is whether, in fact, the officers hit him in the head as opposed to the shoulder.
Right, because Deputy Hoke said, well, you know, I did it in the shoulder. He said the back of the head, and the officer said, yeah, if the blows were the back of the head, that would be unreasonable.
And what I would... Do you have a case on that one, on that point, that the when in some confused manner the dog and the suspect are sort of grappling with each other, what case tells the officer you can punch his shoulder but not his head? Well, I, not just these guys said, oh, yeah, we shouldn't have punched the head. I mean,
well, I think what's it goes, the case? You could, I don't know of a case exactly.
I mean, wouldn't you agree you need a clearly established, you know, you need clearly established authority? It says you can't punch the guy the way they punched him.
I think you have clearly established authority, like I said, going back to 97 and 06, where it talks about where there's no need to use force, you don't use it. The officer said,
very general case law at that point.
Well, but that's the general principle. Okay, and that's a specific principle.
You know, but I mean, it's not might not be so clear to an officer whose dog is in this struggle with this guy that, you know, these very general cases saying don't use force if you don't need to would apply to that particular scenario.
Well, I again, you don't have to. I think it was the Hope case that says you don't have to have a case with an exact fact pattern. And I know there's some Supreme Court cases coming out, and yeah, that's in flux. See, who knows what's going to happen with all that. But I think Hope still hasn't been overruled, and it's still that principle of, that you can use these general principles. And the general principle is, look, you got a guy who's not fighting you. There's no need, you know, to use force on him, whether it's a blow to the head, whether it's a punch in the stomach. I mean, that principle still is appropriate and still gives the lesson to be adhered to in this case.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so with that, Your Honors, I think, you know, I want to make the last point. I think the district court judge did a pretty thorough job on this, analyzing the case law. I don't view the district court, contrary to Brother Counsel's view, of divining some new rule. I think what the district court did is what it was supposed to do. It's supposed to go through those Graham factors. It's supposed to look at the totality of the circumstances. It's
supposed to cite a case that's kind of on point, too.
Well, and I believe it did that. And you know, it's the one, the Campbell case, and I think it's the other cases that we cited here today. I think those are very clear, and those clearly establish the duty of what officers are supposed to do in using a canine. And so the district court did that. And at the end of the day, you know, kind of our dialogue here today is kind of evident why this has to go to a jury, right? Because how are we going to view this video? How are we going to view this testimony? Credibility questions. Judge Murphy, are we going to believe a guy who said he was passed out to think he couldn't have heard a warning? Those are all jury questions. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Do we have some rebuttal?
I mean, one thing I'd like to know is there a release command? And why didn't the, so now I'm wondering, you know, is there an obligation about release as opposed to an obligation about restraint before the bite? Is there an obligation to release? And if so, you know, why didn't they tell him to release the guy? I mean, the guy's probably not a threat at the point he's getting, like, chewed up in the struggle.
Well, so, Your Honor, first thing first is that the argument that it was a prolonged seizure, prolonged detention isn't an argument that's been made here in this brief, in the appeal. The second part is that...
Is there a release command?
Is there a release command? Well, I think there... So
there's this command, it's all in German.
Right, exactly, yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
But, okay, so there's the bite command, which is apparently what Officer Hauff was telling the dog. Is there a release command?
I believe there is.
Wouldn't he say release the guy at this point?
Because the resistance was continuing, right?
And so the resistance is going to continue as long as an animal is attached to oneself, typically. I mean, isn't that sort of obvious?
No, because so what happens, and you can see this play out in this particular seizure, right? So the dog finds him in the weeds, they begin struggling, mm-hmm. and, you know, there are a bunch of commands that are given. The struggle continues, and the district court found that the struggle continued, and, you know, Jarvell admitted, I was trying to get, you know, the dog's mouth off of my arm.
Right, as anyone would.
I don't disagree with that. And then at the end, you know, eventually he did stop struggling, and he, you know, rolled onto his stomach, right? And at that point, when the resistance against the seizure stops, then the dog is released. And that's typically how these shake out, if you look at the cases, I believe.
Yeah, so, I guess, I mean, it's obviously an instinct to try to get the dog off oneself. And at some point, I guess people figure out that's not going to work. and sort of, it must take like a true effort of like cognition and will to stop trying to get this animal off, just that, you know, instinct, and instead say, okay, I'm actually going to roll over and just let the animal stay there, and maybe that will bring a different outcome.
Right, at which point the officer would resist.
Right. And again, but why wouldn't an officer, if the guy is just obviously not a threat, he's laying there in his underwear being chewed up by this Belgian canine, why isn't there an obligation, sort of like, it's a different situation than the case where the guy's laying next to the car and the dog's chewing him up. But maybe it's arguably similar. Why isn't there an obligation to release when it's pretty obvious that this guy's not going to be a threat to me and he ain't getting away either? So, you know, whatever the German word is for release, say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, number one, I don't think it's necessarily that obvious, right? I mean, I think as a court, you know, you obviously watch the video. Everything happens pretty quickly. He jumps up, he pops up out of the weeds, and there's a struggle, and it's not clear exactly what's happening. They don't know if he's armed or not, right? I mean, they make a big point that he's not armed, but the officers don't know.
He's got no shirt on.
Exactly. But again, it all happens very quickly, right? And so if there is a, you know, and I think the cases look, you know, indicate this, where if the suspect is there and the officers have a good ability to be able to see, yeah, this guy's not really going to pose a threat, at that point, you've got to do something, right? You've got to de-escalate the situation. This particular case didn't involve that, right?
Okay, so that's sort of saying, you know, as applied to this case, that obligation wouldn't hold. I mean, would you agree that under the case law and sort of under a sense of reasonableness, which is what we bring to, I guess, this inquiry, that if the dog's biting somebody who is just clearly not a threat, then there's an obligation to say release?
It very well could be. I think one thing, and again, we're getting now to releases as opposed to the warning in the first place, right?
Yeah, right. Warning business.
Yeah.
On a different point.
Yeah. So I think, what I would say is that, you know, imposing a bright line rule in these circumstances, which are highly fact dependent, is a little bit fraught.
But don't your folks want some guidance about, you know, their obligations, as opposed to always just, oh well, you know, we have qualified immunity?
Well, I think, you know, as Mr. Peters indicated, apparently during the trainings, some of these folks do want guidance. But I would say, you know, the Fourth Circuit imposed on the warning piece, they imposed a rule that when you release the dog, you got to warn, right? That's the rule in the Fourth Circuit. And then they had this case, the Melgar case, where the dog was on the leash, and Judge Wilkinson said, well, look, we're going to limit that rule about warning. We're going to limit that to when you release the dog. We're going to, you know, if he's on the leash, you don't have to give a warning. And then there was a case, an unpublished case in the Fourth Circuit, Rogers versus Smith, where there was a traffic stop, and the one of the officers thought that the suspect was going to draw a gun. And so he just released the dog without a warning. And in that case, they said, well, I know we've got that rule, but here there were, you know, particularly exigent circumstances.
Sure.
So that just, you know, when you're trying to draw a bright line,
maybe shooting the guy.
Exactly. So that indicates, you know, when you're drawing a bright line rule, it doesn't match very perfectly on some of these circumstances, and you might have circumstances where it's perfectly reasonable to release the dog without a warning, you know, you wouldn't want a bright line rule to kind of, you know, handcuff the cops in that particular situation. So
I think we understand your argument. Unless you've got something essential, go ahead.
You know, I guess I would just, I do have a record site for the length of leash if you're interested in that. So that's, it's a deposition site. It's Houck deposition at page 50 to 51, where it indicates, you know, he started on a longer lead and then he choked up on the lead. So that was only between, the dog was only between 5 and 10 feet away during the track. Mm-hmm. So if the court is looking for that.
Great.
And unless there's any other questions, I can address the head strikes, but I think once you take the warning part away, Officer Houck is in the same position as Officer Trevino, and Officer Trevino got qualified immunity for the taser that happened after the hand strikes. And so I think it's pretty clear that Officer Houck is entitled to qualified immunity for use of force during the same period of time. Mm-hmm. Unless the panel has other questions.
Thanks to all three of you for your helpful briefs.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. The case will be submitted, and the court may call the third case.